Welcome back to part three of the sex episode. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Steve Dubois, professor of psychology at Adler, to talk with us about non-monogamous relationships. And before we jump into that conversation, I want to remind everyone to please hit subscribe as you're listening so that you don't miss a moment of any of the content we bring to you each and every week. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is. It's a pleasure to have you and your expertise. So before we get into all of the depth of this conversation, let's start with a definition of monogamy.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Let's start with the definition of non-monogamy.
Sure. We all know that other one. Non-monogamy is something that people in a relationship, typically that relationship includes two people, but of course it can include more, when they openly agree on this new arrangement. So the new arrangement is basically when people come together, when people decide that either together or separately, they'll engage in sex with people outside their primary relationship. So it's not a PC term for cheating. Instead, it's a way for individuals in some couples to grow both individually and together while exploring outside the relationship under a set of rules that they decide on.
Okay, so this is maybe a newfangled term for an open relationship.
Yeah, and in fact, in the research now it's called consensual non-monogamy, or CNM. And so that implies that there is a deal made by the people in the relationship and terms are agreed to.
It seems so official to have it be less official. All right.
So takes the fun out of it a little.
Well, yeah, it might, I guess, maybe. But I'm thinking people who are involved with these kind of relationships probably don't call it that. So I'd like to talk to you about having a non-monogamous relationship.
Sure.
I think that they use probably less official terms. When people are deciding to have this conversation, what are the reasons behind it?
Good question. So, you know, according to the top thinkers in the field, there's sort of a new emerging research finding that in order to make love last, there has to be both a mix of comfort in the relationship and risk-taking in the relationship. So intimacy has this sort of counterintuitive effect on desire. The closer we get to someone, the more aligned we become with that person and how we think and what we value. And also physiologically, the less our bodies respond to one another, the longer we've been together, the more we know each other. And so for long-term couples, and certainly for some short-term couples as well, there can be difficulty here as they become more aligned and some of that spark is lost. So some people interpret that lack of physiological arousal, that lack of exciting thoughts or emotions as a lack of desire for the partner. So in that case, non-monogamy or consensual non-monogamy or being in an open relationship provides the opportunity to take a risk together, thereby potentially cultivating the two people in the relationship's closeness and even their connectedness while exploring outside the relationship.
Okay, so the research is suggesting that having a non-monogamous relationship can make you more connected with the person you were in the monogamous relationship with.
Yeah, it's amazing. So increasingly, there's research done on this, and the findings are certainly mixed, so it's not like every study on this topic finds the same things all the time. But certainly, past studies on both gay male couples who participate in this arrangement, lesbian couples, and also heterosexual couples show that there are either no differences in things like depression, individual depression, anxiety, or that they're better off. Those things are better off for people in non-monogamous relationships. Also things like sexual intimacy, trust, those things are reported sometimes more highly in the consensual non-monogamous relationships than the monogamous ones.
Which is just throws everything that people have talked about out the window for so long. So how do couples come to have this conversation and decide that this is right for them?
Sure. Well, some relationships will begin on non-monogamous terms, or you might hear colloquially, like, we're in an open relationship, mm-hmm. Those relationships.
We hear it about celebrities all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
and some will start that way. And typically that's because either one person or both in the relationship express a desire from the start. Then there's another group of couples. Those are those who decide to be monogamous to start, or maybe they don't even decide. It's just implicit. But then they make a decision more actively that they'd like to try non-monogamy. And that comes up usually in one of two ways. The first is that one person has an active desire for something we would call extra dyadic, or outside the dyad, outside the two people in the relationship. But that person wants to be open with, that is, they want to be upfront. They want to articulate that desire to their partner. They want to be honest with their partner about it. And that type of honesty and verbal openness predicts a more positive experience than, say, if the person engaged in infidelity. The other way that non-monogamy comes up is when couples see it as a proactive approach to making their sex lives more exciting. Having an openness to experience sex with other people before things start to feel like they're dwindling might be more of a preventative mindset to avoid that sense of feeling stuck or stagnant in the relationship.
All right. So this isn't necessarily having someone else join them in their sexual activity. This is actually going outside and finding different partners for themselves.
Great question. So this is where we get into the nuances of things. I mean, you can imagine the many, many iterations of non-monogamy or openness. And so it comes in many forms. Sometimes it is the first thing that you said, where maybe, and I think it was the first thing, maybe couples go out together and they kind of, we would say they play with other partners together.
Okay.
And another form of this.
Threesome.
Threesomes, foursomes, fivesomes.
Et cetera.
Right.
Yeah.
And then another iteration of this involves, again, agreed upon rules where each individual in the relationship can go seek their own sexual experience, not within the context of the relationship itself with the partner physically present. And in fact, yet another name that's been used to describe those types of relationships, some of those relationships, is something coined by Dan Savage years ago and then used in the research called monogamish relationships, which is, you know, sort of monogamous. And those are typically reserved for people who seek sex with someone else outside the relationship together.
Okay. All right. So how do these work? And obviously we can't cover all of this because, as you've said, there's as many different variations of this as there are people who are involved with this. But just sort of on average-ish,
sure,
if you would give
sure
me the overview.
And we do have averages, right? There's been okay enough research done that we can say typically it looks something like this. There have been some key components of non-monogamy that have kind of arisen from the literature and from clinical work with these individuals. And so those key components, I would say there are three, although certainly there are more if you keep looking for them. One is communication. I mean, it's the cornerstone of all relationships, but particularly when you are in a non-monogamous relationship, there's almost a painstaking amount of communication that's required, at least if you want to do it, I think, effectively. Communicating pre any sort of non-monogamous sexual experience, communicating during that to make sure you're staying connected, communicating after, kind of debriefing what happened, what did we learn, what do we want to change. So there's a lot of communication, which actually leads to some of the potential connectedness and closeness that is reported.
Mm-hmm.
Some couples start to communicate more than they ever have about sex when they start to kind of open up this option. A second key component, I would say, is flexibility. So flexibility in terms of what kind of non-monogamous relationship individuals are going to have. Who are they going to include? When? Where? All of the questions. So it's good to set those terms, but also be flexible to change. For example, you can imagine setting some terms and one or both partners not really jiving with those terms after they experiment with them. And so having an openness to be flexible to set new terms, I think, is really important as
well.
All
right. So we thought we came to an agreement and we were all, and then one of the people says, yeah, I'm not down with this caveat.
Indeed.
And then so you just kind of regroup and rehash. Okay.
Exactly. Which then presents an opportunity for problem solving together, which is another key kind of relationship facet that we know in the literature and clinical work really helps to build and maintain relationships. Related to that is, I would say, the third kind of key component of non-monogamy working, which is a prioritization of the partnership over the individual's needs. This can be tricky because sometimes, of course, one person is the one driving the desire to be non-monogamous. But I think it's really important for couples to discuss it openly and frequently before engaging in it, so that it can be reframed as something that's good not just for the individual but for the relationship. And I think that's true, that often, you know, or almost always, what's good for the individual in a relationship is good for the relationship because an individual brings the best to the relationship. But I think those connections need to be made between the people in relationships. They need to be articulated, explored. And so I think that having those discussions helps to maintain that the relationship is going to take priority over, for example, an individual's sexual whims.
All right. I actually caught my reflection at one point during this conversation, and I can tell you that I was so amused by how perplexed I was by this avenue of thinking that that I really have to ask, is this common, or is this something that people have been doing and we just haven't talked about? Or because for me, I'm like, who does this? Mm-hmm. I've never thought about this before. But that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation, so that it can be out there. If this is something that 20% of the population is involved in, then this is something that we should be talking about far more frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple things are happening simultaneously. It's becoming more common as a practice in relationships, and it's also becoming less stigmatized. So back in 2013, President Obama was on Good Morning America and gave support for gay marriage, but he actually qualified it by stating that he's supportive of monogamous relationships. And so even then, there was a little stigma associated with gay marriage, like only if it's under these terms.
As long as it's always what we've always accepted.
Exactly. The convention, right? And so we see, and of course, not to knock President Obama, but just to say, when looking at that a little closely, we actually picked up on some stigma there that was disseminated. 2-3 years later, I think there's less stigma, at least in the research, there's less stigma, and there's a higher prevalence than there used to be. It's one of those tough things. It's tough to get prevalence rates for, because who knows if more are out there, we're just not capturing them, or people aren't telling us. But it's certainly more common, as stated earlier, in gay male relationships and lesbian relationships. In studies of gay males, the highest reported prevalence has been upwards of 60% of gay male couples participate in this type of arrangement. Much, much smaller proportions of heterosexual couples. For example, the going prevalence is about 5% of heterosexual couples classify themselves as open or in swinger type relationships.
That term is so funny. Okay. Well, I honestly, thank you so much for sharing this information with me and everyone, because this has given me a ton. It's so much to think about. Thank you, Steve. And this is going to conclude our show. Please join us next week for our episode, Fighting Addiction. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, presented by Adler University. Make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast on iTunes or on your Android app store, wherever you are able to download those from. We appreciate it. And again, next week, we will be talking about fighting addiction. That will be a can't miss. We'll talk to you next week.